The first thing I have to do is show the next generation that it is possible to make money on low inputs like this and rotational grazing, raising cattle. Corn and beans, kind of, you looked over the fence and say, these guys are all raising corn and beans. I could do that too, but we have to show the next generation that there is alternatives to just corn and beans in this country, and especially when it comes to taking care of the soil.
Welcome to the 404th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. There's a lot of talk in the regenerative agriculture movement about the need for a tight nutrient cycle. A loose, leaky nutrient cycle is bad for a farmer's bank account and bad for the environment. For example, the row cropping system that currently dominates the Midwest is heavily reliant on commercial forms of nitrogen-based fertilizer. The problem with nitrogen is it's particularly difficult to keep in one place long enough to be taken up by growing plants. As a result, an extraordinary amount of that fertilizer makes its way into our water in the form of nitrate, which is a pollutant harmful both to aquatic life and human health. In the U.S., on average, over 34 pounds of nitrogen is lost on each cultivated crop acre per year. To put that in context, the average Midwestern corn grower annually applies roughly 150 pounds of nitrogen per acre. In Minnesota, 70% of nitrogen pollution comes from commercial fertilizer escaping cropland. If our row cropping nutrient cycle was a wheel rolling down the road, it would be steadily hissing a lot of very expensive escaped air. So what's an example of a tight nutrient cycle? Perhaps the best way to explain that is to introduce you to a farm in southeastern Minnesota owned and operated by Paul and Dolores Mechnig. This 160-acre operation in a hilly portion of the Driftless region raises beef cattle utilizing rotationally grazed pastures along with hay and corn. Virtually every plant grown on that farm is cycled through the cattle in the form of manure, which then goes back onto the land, feeding the soil so that it can produce more livestock feed, and on in a continuous loop. The Mechnigs have been raising livestock this way for around 25 years when they first started breaking up their pastures into grazing paddocks and rotating the cattle frequently. They went full bore into beef production in 2020 after they sold their dairy herd. Today, they graze their own beef cow herd as well as do custom grazing for neighbors. The Mechnigs' focus on building a tight nutrient cycle was a hot topic of discussion during a soil health hub gathering the Land Stewardship Project facilitated at the farm on a recent June evening. LSP's soil health hubs are a collection of four farmer-to-farmer networks representing three regions in southeastern Minnesota and one in northeastern Iowa. These hubs are opportunities for livestock and crop producers to take part in the kind of peer-to-peer learning required to step out of the mainstream and build a farming system based on living, biologically rich soil. As the current soil health revolution farming is in the midst of continues to evolve, it's becoming clearer than ever that traditional methods of information transfer simply aren't adequate to meet the needs of farmers seeking to take a different approach to food and fiber production. Each LSP soil health hub is kept small enough, around a half dozen to a dozen members or so, to make one-to-one connections possible as farmers take turns hosting hub meetings, not as just a show-and-tell type exercise, but as a way to address burning questions such as land access, soil monitoring, weed management, grazing herd profitability, marketing headaches, pasture and cover crop seed mixes, and ways of wintering livestock. At the soil hub gathering the Mechnigs hosted, Paul took a half a dozen farmers on a tour of the operation's grazing paddocks. They also waded into a beautiful stand of barley he's planning on using as a source of feed, as well as a way to kickstart a new hay field. Afterwards, the hub members gathered in the Mechnigs' yard, where Paul handed out a written outline of how much his expenses have skyrocketed in the last year alone. The other farmers nodded emphatically as Paul discussed the dire need to figure out a way to get an even tighter grip on fuel and fertilizer costs. The general consensus was that you can only control what you can control. In this case, farms like the Mechnigs offer a model for controlling the cost of fertilizer by cranking down on that nutrient cycle and making it as tight and circular as possible. Paul and Dolores are in their 70s and are starting to think a lot about how to not only make sure their farm is efficiently cycling nutrients, but is doing it in a way that makes the operation attractive to the next generation. As it happens, they have a son, Jim, who's transitioning into taking over the farm and continuing the focus on regenerative livestock production. After the Soil Hub meeting, Paul sat down with me to talk about what attracted him to rotational grazing, how they set their system up to optimize the production of forages, and how this has all fed into creating the kind of tight nutrient cycle farmers need if they're to build the kind of soil that's less reliant on expensive inputs. Paul also talked about how, even as a veteran grazer, he's always adapting new ideas and finds the kind of peer-to-peer learning available through the Soil Health Hubs more valuable than ever. So, Paul, you were talking to me earlier about about 25 years ago, started rotational grazing. And I was wondering if you could describe what drew you to rotational grazing. What was it about that that you decided to do that? I will say that we're in really hilly country here. This is kind of the Zumbro River Valley area. And it's set up nicely for grazing because it's pretty steep ground for raising corn and beans, that type of thing. So it lays nice for pasture, that kind of thing. But what was it that drew you to rotational grazing?
Our first experience on rotational grazing was for grazing bred Holstein heifers and some steers. We would raise our male calves up to about 700-800 pounds and then sell them as feeders just to make the work easier and have to put up less feed. We tried the rotational grazing and it worked. It was on a small number. It was probably 15 head at the most that we did it with. I tried 1 year to rotational graze the milk cows. It lasted about a week because of logistics of getting them to the pasture from the barn and back and forth. Being steep ground here, it did not work, especially when it rained. And then when we sold the cows, because I always had a few beef cows, and I rented pasture for a few years, and then I decided to keep them here and raise them or graze them ourselves, and that took off. And then when we sold the dairy herd, then it was just every year expanding a little bit more on the beef herd, and that would expand the acres of grazing also. And so we've been grazing the beef herd and the calves, and it's very successful. It's good for the ground. And
you have your own beef cow herd that you own, but you're also doing custom grazing for a neighbor, is that correct? Can you describe that a little bit?
Last year we custom grazed dairy heifers, and I thought it was very successful for the dairy farmer that owned the heifers. This year we have a herd of beef cows in here, 18 cows with calves that were custom grazing. The custom grazing animals, we weigh them coming in. With the beef calves, we weighed the calves. The Holstein heifers, we weighed them coming in. And we also weigh them going out, so we have numbers to know what our work is producing, how much we have to charge for it. When we do our own cows on grazing, I have a birth weight on the calves. We weigh them all coming in off grass when we wean them. We weigh the calves as yearlings. If we sell them as feeders, we weigh them before they get sold. There again, it goes down to this fact we have to measure what we want to manage, or if you can't manage, if you can't measure what you're doing.
How big is the herd that you own?
Since I was getting older here, I cut the herd back from, at one time I run 74 beef cows here. I cut it back to 55 when I started drawing Social Security. And now, as I'm getting older, we had it cut down to 35. Now with the sun coming in, we have to decide whether we're going to increase again or increase custom grazing. It's up in the air yet. We're breeding a bunch of heifers this year so that we can start increasing the herd that we own.
Can you describe a little bit the kind of grazing setup you have? You have, how many paddocks you have and how often you move the cattle and that kind of thing?
I've got the pasture set up so that we move the cattle every 3 to 4 days. I like to have the grass rest for 30 to 33 days. If it gets dry, if they don't have grass, I don't accelerate the switching of grass. I feed the cattle instead so that the grass always has the 30 to 33 days of rest. Long run, it's better for the grass to do that and feed the cows for a week or even 3-4 days. About 4 years ago, I think we're operating on 4 years now, we put in water lines and tanks out to every pasture, and that has improved the quality of the grass out there, because the far pastures that the cattle had to walk half a mile to get water back and forth from grass, they utilize those much better now when they're out there constantly. They got pastures east side of the farm and west side of the farm. And so the west side's divided into 9 pastures. And if you multiply that times 3.5 days, you come up with the 30 to 33 days rest period for each one. The pastures are pretty close, all of them, to the same size. The other side, the east side here, we've got a couple more paddocks there. I think there's 11 total. 8 of them are all the same size. And then we graze some here where there's trees and a few trees and around the buildings. That's set up so that they can be grazed there. Here again, that's fixed up so you get that 33-day rest period on the grass. We can run just a few more cows on the east pasture than the west. And when I was running 55 cows, then they would... We'd get the east side grazed, then they'd go to the west side and then come back and start over. I keep track of the days they go into a pasture and when I move them, everything, so I can look back and make sure that that pasture gets its 30 days of rest. I do apply some commercial fertilizer on them. I have. I think with the cows being out there, with the water being there, so the cows are there all the time, we have increased the amount of manure that's used as fertilizer on those pastures, so that eventually I think the commercial fertilizer can be cut down. One of the reasons for commercial fertilizer is to get maximum production so I could keep the maximum number of cows on there. It's a matter of income and stuff, but right now we have to ramp up again because my son is getting involved in it. And so when it was just me and my wife, we didn't have to have work as hard as we did all the time.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of fertilizer, that is the hot topic right now for a lot of farmers, because the price has gone so crazy, and it's such a key input both for crop farmers and people who are trying to, you know, develop good forages, that kind of thing. And you had a great discussion here at the Hub meeting where you had shared some calculations of showing how much your fertilizer prices have gone up. I was wondering if you could just go over that, because it really prompted a really good discussion about, well, what can we come back, what can we afford to cut back on, and at what point are we kind of cutting off our nose to spite our face, but like we're cutting back too much and then we're not getting the productivity that we want, but then how much can rotational grazing make up for that kind of thing, how much your fertilizer prices have gone up. It was really, just to see that in writing was, for one farm, was like, oh my gosh. And it's not like you're farming thousands of acres of corn and beans, but it still really hits you in the pocketbook, it sounds like.
Nitrogen is what really went up in 12 months here, from May of last year to May of this year, went up 43-44%. Potash went up about 8-9%. Those are the two main ingredients. I also used some DAP on the starter fertilizer, and that went up 6-7%. Between the nitrogen and the diesel fuel to have fertilizer delivered, those costs really went up. And the diesel fuel that I bought here on the farm in 1 year's time went up from $2.84 to $4.44 a gallon in just, you know, a year's time. So all those things make a difference, and rotational grazing has allowed me to cut my fuel bill immensely. And also because the cows are harvesting the grass, I also make hay here, and making hay is not as expensive as raising corn when it comes to fuel.
But you feel like the rotational grazing, because the cattle are out there, they're returning the fertility to the,
yes,
to this, that you can reduce your reliance on purchased fertilizer?
Yes, I think that's what will happen here over the years, because as we watch the soil test, phosphorus is now in a high state or high range, the potash is going up, and we don't test for nitrogen, but the organic matter really increases faster, a lot faster than it will on raising corn and beans. When we can raise the organic matter, we're increasing the holding capacity for moisture in the ground. Increase the holding capacity and have more organic matter, we're going to have more nitrogen available, and I believe the phosphorus and potash will also become more available. Plus, having the grass cover on there, it's not subject to erosion.
You know, it strikes me that you are in a much more, I guess, resilient position when it comes to when input prices really go through the roof like this. You can, you know, you can't do away completely with bringing in commercial fertilizer. You're not at that situation yet, but you are able to maybe by building, but kind of do being more self-sufficient in your own fertility by building it up through the rotational grazing and getting the cattle out there and disturbing the soil and getting that manure on there. You are able to maybe weather those huge spikes in input prices a little bit more and kind of not be as reliant on that.
That's right. The break even for raising corn here is less than somebody that's raising 1,000 acres of it because of my manure resources and short rotation. If I usually use 2 years of corn at maximum, and then it either gets rotated into grain and hay, or I'll rotate it to grain and then come back with a corn again, but never 3 years of corn in a row or more. The break even on that for corn is much better. Plus, the corn all gets fed to the livestock. I don't sell a kernel of corn off the farm.
So you have a really tight nutrient cycle there, it sounds like.
Yes. Everything that's raised here, or the crops that are raised here, are fed here, and they come back through the manure or in the corn stalks or residue from hay, the root matter from a hay crop that gets plowed down.
Yeah, you were explaining a little bit. One of the ways you can save costs is you're not invested in a combine or a lot of harvest equipment, for example, because you're using the cattle to harvest a lot of this stuff, and you're able to feed your crops right back into the system a little bit. Yeah, you don't have to invest as much in that kind of harvest, so much overhead into harvest equipment, that kind of thing.
My harvest equipment for corn is a two-row New Idea corn picker, and it eliminates hauling the corn to town to get dried or having a dryer here on the farm to dry it, or hiring a combine to harvest it. I raise anywhere from 10 to 16, 17 acres of corn a year. Those kind of acres do not justify huge expenditure in machinery. When it comes to harvesting hay, I chop almost all the hay and put it in silage bags because that's the cheapest way to harvest it and retain the most feed value on an acre of harvested feed.
One of the stops we made on our little tour was this barley field. And for one thing, it's a very beautiful crop. And it's so great to see a small grain like that kind of get rotated back into the rotation. And can you describe why you're raising that? It's kind of a, you've underseeded it with a forage mix a little bit, and you've got, this is kind of a multi-year plan that you're going to, but describe what you're going to use the barley for initially, and then kind of what the plan is for that field after that.
The barley initially is used as a cover crop to get alfalfa and grass established for to become a hay field next year. To do that, I chop the barley, put it in a bag, and use it to feed the beef cows. It makes wonderful beef cow feed, maybe sometimes a little bit too rich for them, but that is good. Then I also have a barley field this year that I have peas with that, and I will be chopping that off, putting it in a bag, and then I'm going to turn around and reseed that with sorghum sedan grass and get another crop of forage off before fall comes. This is on land that's on the other side of the road, so I can't get the cows across to it very easily. So we try and double crop whenever we can like that.
How old are you, Paul?
I'm 76 years old.
You had to hesitate a little bit there. I don't know if you remembered. No, you look pretty good for 76, I got to say. Well, the reason I ask is the other people that were present at this pasture walk tonight was your son, Jim. Is that his name, Jim? And two of your granddaughters. And I understand that Jim is kind of in the process of starting to transition into taking over the farm. I think that's really great because that is a big issue is transitioning those farms onto the next generation. I'm wondering, because you have this farm set up as a kind of a rotational grazing beef operation and you're using a lot of low inputs, and it sounds like you've got it set up as a pretty efficient system too. Like as a 76-year-old guy, you're able to set up these paddocks and kind of run it and not have to run a lot of heavy equipment, that type of thing. Does that make make it a little bit more attractive for the next generation to take over a farm like this? And does that make it, I guess, make you feel a little bit more positive about the future of handing this off to somebody and that they could make a go of it?
Yes. The first thing I have to do is show the next generation that it is possible to make money on low inputs like this and rotational grazing, raising cattle. Not every year the cattle make money, but at least the soil stays here. The quality of life, you can have some time off because you're not tending other dairy herd. Corn and beans, it's kind of, you looked over the fence and say, these guys are all raising corn and beans. I could do that too, but we have to show the next generation that there is alternatives to just corn and beans in this country, and especially when it comes to taking care of the soil.
You know, this pasture walk is part of these soil health hubs that LSP has been holding, where we get people together, and in particular, the ones that have really been kind of going is the groups that kind of get together to talk about grazing, which can be, it's a great system, but there's can be a real learning curve with that. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, because you've been doing it now for 25 years, and things have changed a lot in grazing. I guess I had two questions. One is, what have been the main things that have changed in grazing since you got started? But the other thing I wanted to ask you is how valuable is it to be able to get together with other farmers and talk about some of these management challenges with grazing, especially as you know, dealing with different weather situations every year is a little bit different, that kind of thing.
Main things that have changed with grazing is developing the types of grass out there and limiting your time that the cattle graze and the rest periods on there. Also, the fertility level. And then the next biggest thing that I saw was getting water out to every pasture. That has really helped the production cycle on the grass, and that translates into more pounds of beef.
Yeah, with things changing so much, and with every year can be different, and it just is never one the same. We were just talking about the weather, and this morning it was 50 degrees here in middle of June, and we kind of had four seasons in one day, and so things can really change and can really challenge somebody when you're trying to do a grazing system, especially if maybe you're just getting started or you're transitioning to a different way of doing things or different breed of livestock, types of livestock, that type of thing. But yeah, how useful is it for you to be able to get together with some farmers? The one thing I was just noticing, the discussions here today, just in this short amount of time, range from talking about different pasture mixes to maybe what kind of breeds work best on grass systems to ways of managing your fertility to the market situation to, the price of fertilizer. There was just really ranged, and it was, it was really interesting. And there's a range of farmers here. There's farmers who have been doing it quite a bit. There's ones that are kind of just getting started a little bit. So it was a kind of a range in experience as well. But how useful is that for folks to get together and talk a little bit about some of these challenges with a practice like this?
Okay, there's two things there. Number one is you aren't going to find two farmers that manage everything the same way. Mm-hmm. So there's always that variable. It's always good to see how somebody else does something. Look with the aspect of looking at new ideas that you can incorporate yourself. The other thing is don't get hung up on doing the same thing every year the same way, because there's too many variables here. There's amount of sunlight, there's amount of rain you get, there's how cold it is in the spring, how cold it is early in the fall, how hot it gets in the summer. All these things affect the growth of grass. So you have to be willing to change and adapt to the variables that are presented to you.
And it must be just kind of fun to get together with some folks who are thinking along the same way as you are.
Oh, yeah, it's always good to talk to somebody else and share these ideas. And I'm not always right, and I'm not always wrong, but they're not always right, and they're not always wrong. It's the sharing of these ideas that's important to make this work for the benefit of each farm.
Before I wrap up this podcast, I've got a bonus interview I'd like to share. During the Soil Health Hub meeting, Dolores McNig was generous enough to show me one of the many nest boxes she and Paul have set up in the grazing paddocks for eastern bluebirds and tree swallows. Sure enough, at the bottom of a nesting container made from a PVC pipe were three baby swallows. Meanwhile, dozens of adult swallows were swooping over the pasture grasses, snatching flies and other insects out of the air on a June evening. As two McNig granddaughters joined me in examining the swallow nestlings, it became clear that Paul and Dolores are attempting to make this farm attractive to the next generation on many levels. Besides swallows and bluebirds, eastern meadowlarks, bobolinks, and dickcissels are drawn to this farm, which is an oasis of perennial plant cover in an area dominated by corn and soybeans. In addition, they have windbreaks and other wooded habitat, which is attracting rose-breasted grosbeaks, orioles, finches, and various kinds of woodpeckers, including red-headed woodpeckers, which have experienced significant population declines in Minnesota over the years. Dolores took a moment to talk to me about what the farmers have learned over the years about how to provide good nesting spots for swallows and bluebirds. She also talked about what seeing and hearing these wild residents tells her family about the way they farm. So Dolores, we were just did a little kind of a pasture walk here on the farm and saw some of the grazing systems you and Paul have set up here with the beef herd. And I know you've been involved with grazing for several years, I think probably over 25 years here. And this is a really nice setup. But one of the things I noticed when we went out to the grazing paddocks and we're looking at those was the number of birds. And I have a Merlin app, and I had that on, and it was going crazy. I was just hearing a ton of birds. And it sounds like it's something that you really have taken an interest in birds, and it looks like I saw some birdhouses set up, like bird boxes, I guess, nesting boxes, and you've got a nice windbreak here with some wildlife habitat. But can you talk a little bit about kind of what your interest in birds is?
Well, I guess bluebirds are my favorite, and I mean, I've got a feeder there on the other side of the house with black oil sunflower seeds, and enjoy watching the rose-breasted and grosbeaks, and even been getting red-headed woodpeckers and all the other woodpeckers and Baltimore orioles that are when I have the grape jelly out there. And yeah, I enjoy watching the birds, and we've had the bluebird. Paul started making them way back many years ago, started making the houses, and we would just stick them up on a wooden post here and there and didn't really know the best way to do it, but we've learned over the years that it's best to have them like 300 or 400 feet apart and put them in pairs so that one, the bluebirds will take one and a tree swallow will take the other one. And since they're both territorial, the bluebird won't let another bluebird live close, and a tree swallow won't let another tree swallow live close, but it'll let the bluebirds and tree swallows can live close.
Yeah.
And anyway, we have like 12 pairs scattered around, and this year I think as far as I know, there's only four of them that have a bluebird in one of the houses, mm-hmm. and I think just about every pair has got a tree swallow in the other one. So,
yeah.
But tree swallows are good birds too. And you put them on, you don't want to put them on a wooden fence post because the raccoons can just get to them way too easy. And so we have them, some of them are on T-posts. I know that the experts would maybe say that's not the best way either, because raccoons could possibly climb up the mm-hmm. T-posts, but so they say to mount them on conduit. And And you can usually tell which ones are bluebirds because they make a nice, neat nest, and the tree swallows' nests are all lined with feathers. They'll line their nest really neatly with feathers, and they have smaller white eggs, and the bluebirds have usually blue eggs, but they can have white eggs too. And usually the first batch might be 5 eggs, otherwise 4 or 5 eggs. And then the later they could make a second batch, and that's often 3 or 4 eggs and the second time. And I guess we just don't have as many in the houses this year as we have had some years, but they usually do make a second batch. So,
well, it was really cool. You took down one of the houses, one of the nest boxes, and there was a bunch of little nestling tree swallows in there.
Swallows. And the other box had the bluebirds had flown already, so that one was empty, and they will come back and make a new nest in there and lay another bunch of eggs.
and you kind of explained it, so you have kind of 12 locations set up, but you have 2 nest boxes at each location, and that one, kind of the idea is that bluebirds would be in one and tree swallows would be in the other, because they're, as you explained, they're very territorial.
Yes. So, yeah, and a person can get, I've never had any chickadees in, but sometimes a person can get chickadees, but wrens and sparrows like to take the nest boxes too, and they're not something. I mean, wrens will, if they want to take over a nest, they will kill baby bluebirds. Wrens can be really nasty, and sparrows definitely will. They might. I've had where a sparrow made a nest right over the top of baby bluebirds, and when they wanted to take it over, and so they're nasty, and so that's one thing I like to go around and check and make sure I'm not raising any sparrows or evict them.
Do you use any particular design for the nest boxes that are maybe more that are better than others?
We have mostly the Peterson wooden ones, and we have a few of the PVC type ones, and it seems like the bluebirds seldom use the PVC ones, but I know like when you look at them in state parks that they use mostly PVC houses, and I guess if the bluebirds don't have any other choice, if that's what they all are where they want to nest, then they'll take the PVC ones too, and otherwise the tree swallows will use either one.
And is the Peterson style, that's the one that has the narrow bottom, and what's the idea behind having that narrow bottom there?
I'm not sure if that's I know there's lots of other designs too that are more boxy shaped, but that's just the way Paul started making them, and that's how we've continued. I think there'd be other ones that might be easier to make for people that haven't made them before, because you have to get the angles just right.
Paul was mentioning you feed birds here. You have a bird feeder, and he was kind of, I mean, can you give me a rundown of all the species you see, and not just the grassland birds, but here around the farmstead itself, you see a lot of different. It sounds like there's a rose-breasted grosbeak that's been around, that kind of thing.
I'm coming to, especially earlier in spring, we might have like 3 or 4 males there at a time. They're the colorful ones, and now I know there's at least one pair, because I've seen one at the bird feeder. Well, when I have the jelly out, then it'll get the orioles, and we have all kinds of the finches, house purple finches and house finches, whichever, I'm not sure which one is which, but all kinds of woodpeckers, nuthatches and downies and hairy woodpeckers and red-bellied woodpeckers. One that's Paul calls a flicker, but I think it's really a red-bellied woodpecker. But I've been enjoying really seeing the red-headed woodpeckers. We've seen them a number of times at our sunflower seed feeder, and it's the first time we've had them come to the feeder. So
that's a big deal, because red-headed woodpeckers are really, I think they may be threatened, or they're really declining here in Minnesota. So that's a big deal to see a red-headed woodpecker.
I know, we would see one once in a while other years that would fly across from those oak trees over there over to the, maybe over to our corn crib or something, but to have them come to the feeder, they're still, even this morning, I saw him there yet today, so he's still around.
Do you have kind of a life list that you've kept track of all the birds, or how many birds you've seen?
I guess the ones that, I know there's so many different, like warblers, I don't know one warbler from another, and I guess I'm more interested in the ones that we see here, but it is fun to see, I mean, like to walk through go for a walk and hear those bobolinks and dickcissels and meadowlarks too, we have them too, and I think if it was all corn and beans, we wouldn't see nearly as many.
Well, that was the one thing I was going to raise. So driving here, driving through corn and soybean country, you don't see any sign of birds. And when we went out in the grazing paddocks today, the tree swallows were just going crazy. And one thing I've heard is tree swallows really are helpful keeping flies down. And I was like, oh, now I get it. Because they were feeding, it's kind of in the evening now, mm-hmm. and before sunset, and they were out just hunting like crazy.
And sometimes after we mow, then they'll just be swooping around the yard, you know, right where I mowed, just swooping around catching bugs. And then the flower bed there, there's two birdhouses, one wooden one and one PVC one. And sometimes the bluebirds have had when they've had a nest in the one along the driveway, then they might come up and move into the, last year they moved into the one in the flower bed then and made a second nest there. But then we just put up the PVC one just in case the tree swallows wanted to take the nest. So they took, there's actually a tree swallow nest in that PVC one there in the flower bed.
So I wonder, when you hear the birds and when you see them, like the tree swallows out and then get them nesting, does that kind of give you a sense of, well, some of what the kind of farming that we're doing here with the rotational grazing, and you have more, you know, perennial systems going, and also diverse cropping. I know one of the other things we looked at was the field of barley that you guys are growing, and you know, kind of a more diverse landscape, and then you have kind of interspersed with trees. There's a fair number of trees here, and you've got windbreaks and that kind of thing. Does it kind of give you a sense of, well, maybe we're kind of, it supports the kind of farming that we're doing. That's good news for us. That's a good indicator for us.
Yeah, it's to hear all those different birds, not just the sparrows. I know we can hear sparrows right now too, but we'll hear catbirds and you know, there's brown threshers that we'll see they're in the windbreak, and it's fun just to hear all the variety. And I'm surprised I'm not hearing the bluebirds right now, because often in this time of the evening we'll hear the bluebirds, especially the ones that just left that nest down there, that they'll be sitting on the wire over there. And
I know you guys have been grazing for around 25 years. Did you start to notice more birds as you were doing more of the rotational grazing?
I suppose more because I've been walking out there more. You know, if it's all just a cornfield, or I guess we never have really raised soybeans, but if it's just not as interesting when it's when there isn't the pastures and the hay ground and
it kind of makes the chores more fun, I suppose.
Oh yeah, and even to be in the garden and to be out there working and listening to the different birds. And although sometimes one time, I think it was last year, then those rose-breasted grosbeaks were eating my snap peas. That was wasn't appreciated. But
good thing they're so pretty.
Right.
They get away with it then. Do you know what's the neatest thing you've seen as far as since you started paying attention to the birds here? Anything that really strikes you?
Well, we had been, sometimes I would get mealworms and you can get bluebirds to come and eat mealworms out of a dish, and I haven't done it for quite a few years because you have to buy the live mealworms, and I have pictures of a dish sitting on the porch rail and bluebirds around it. The mother, or the young bluebirds, where mothers brought, the mother bird brought her babies to the dish to eat the mealworms, and so I haven't been feeding them lately.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't for several years, but so that was interesting. That was fun to see them that close, see them come and eat the mealworms.
Wow, that's really cool. Kind of in general, does it just make it more, I guess, enjoyable to be on the farm and to be farming when you kind of can hear the birds and see the birds and kind of realize, oh, well, they're kind of digging what we're doing here too?
Oh, yep. Yeah, it is. And we hear pheasants too. We hear pheasants over that way or back that way. And so it's just nice to have that, to know that they're in the area and that they enjoy our farm.
Yeah, they're kind of honoring you a little bit by what you're doing.
Serenading us.
For more information on LSP's soil health hubs and how to build soil health profitably utilizing practices like managed rotational grazing, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 404 at landstewardshipproject.org. On that page, you'll also see links to other Ear to the Ground podcasts on the relationship between healthy bird habitat and regenerative grazing. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. We'd like to note that this episode, just like all Ear to the Ground podcasts, is the product of work done by real humans. Generative artificial intelligence, also known as generative AI, plays no part in the recording or editing of these shows. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendahl, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.